Is your passcode 00000 by chance?
It is not. I'm also not developing a plane with Apple Incorporated.
Oh, what a day. I'll just let that be what it is.
Just let that one hang. Yeah, no contact. Find out if they want. I'm sure they already know.
Let's see. We have I say this usually, that we have a lot to discuss, but this week we have a lot of different things to discuss, some of which like could be extended topics, but I think this week we're just going to kind of do some quick shots at some of these topics.
Grab bag.
Yeah. A little boomerang here. And we're recording a day late, so we've got like one day extra of stories in the can to discuss. So first off, tell me about the Apple Watch Daylight Savings Time bug. This is the first time Apple's ever had a bug with Daylight Savings Time, right?
Yeah, they've never had anything like this.
Yeah,
before.
And let me correct myself. Daylight Saving Time. Sounds wrong, but it's correct, I guess.
Yeah, it's stupid. Anyway. Daylight Savings is kind of stupid in general, but
yeah.
Yeah, Apple has an infamous relationship with Daylight Savings bugs going all the way back to the iPhone through iPhone 1, even recently. They've been having some interesting calendar bugs and stuff in recent times. Like, about a year to the day, they had that bug in iOS 11 where people's devices would crash and reboot because of like a local notifications bug. And
yeah, that was a bad
to
one.
Fix that, they had to release iOS 11.2 on a Saturday, like the first time ever they did a software update on a weekend. With this one, it was less problematic because it affected the watch and obviously not the iPhone, which is already a magnitude difference in impact. And it affected the time of the daylight savings transition, which obviously doesn't happen at the same time in every place in the world. So on this date, on October 6th, Australians were impacted because they had daylight savings where they lost an hour. So they had a 23-hour day. And it turns out that the new Infograph Modular Activity Complication, which is a chart with lines for 24 hours across the whole day, seemingly could not handle the fact that it had lost an hour and couldn't display an extra hour because it was causing the watches to kind of go into like a boot loop sort of, because it would try and load the complication, something was weird in the code, that would overload the processor, the device would shut down, the device would reboot, and then obviously it comes straight back to the watch face, tries to load the same complication and just repeats over and over. This obviously didn't affect other regions yet, because they had not gone through DST, but the US has it on like November the 4th, and we have it in the UK at the last weekend in October. So it's a pressing problem. People on Reddit and stuff were really confused. Like, all the Australians were all waking up and complaining that their devices just weren't working. I saw quite a few people that had already done like express device replacements at the Apple store, and realistically the fix was A, to wait a day, because when the day changed it would all start working again. So I think a lot of the repair centers are just going to be returning watches upon inspection over the next few days. Or you could maybe try and delete the Infograph complication on the phone app and hope that it syncs to the watch in time before it gets overloaded and shuts down again. But the long and short of it is, a day later it was fixed in Australia, but as far as we know, the same problem is going to happen to other regions in a few days' time when they also have DST, and Apple has not released a public software update since then. So at the moment, everybody's watches are compromised potentially.
Yeah, we had a 5.0.1 update, but that was way before this and didn't address this, and we've not had like a 5.0.2, and as far as we know, we don't know if 5.1 fixes it or if it'll be out before the next round of daylight saving time. So this is interesting to me because I never understand why these DST bugs happen, but this one I can like it's got a visual element to it that I can just totally get, that they didn't account for what happens if you only have 23 days or 23 hours on this, you know, day that has 24 marks, or if you have 25 for some reason. And it, like, you know, it made us wonder, like, what happens if you travel, and you know, is this complication like ready for that even? And it's also interesting to me because it's One country on one new watch with one watch face and one very specific complication. So
yeah, and I don't believe this complication is set up as default as the center one anyway. So
right, I agree.
But obviously it's activity, so it's quite popular.
Indeed.
So, and it's used in all the marketing images. So a lot of people said it, but it's not catastrophic to Apple because it was like, you had to be, there was like five different factors you had to qualify for.
Yeah,
so
but it was enough,
a small number of people.
It was enough to bubble up to be a story to, like, you know, be worth writing about.
And
it was a non-zero number of people who were affected. And oftentimes with the Australia, like the bugs that happened in Australia first, just like we just brace ourselves and wait. I mean, that was the year ago when the same thing happened. It's like it happened in, you know, the Eastern Hemisphere first, and then like it steadily made its way home.
The bug last year to me is less defensible that it happened than this one, because this one's a specific complication on a specific face. You could see how Apple tested like 6 months out with all these different variants, and for whatever reason they just didn't hit this particular time frame where this happened here, or the complication wasn't active. Like with the iPhone, there are a lot less requirements to hit the bug, and it was a lot more problematic, obviously. So it sucks, and haha, the Apple Watch can't deal with time, but I mean, it'll get fixed, but it is kind of funny at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. You know how Apple does all this lobbying for, like, you know, issues that they care about as a company? Anytime there's any kind of a movement to end daylight saving time, I wonder if they really, really are invested in that effort, because all it gives them are problems.
It would help them, but there are plenty of other weirdness in the calendars that would cause similar problems, like leap days.
Plus the whole Unicode thing. I mean, that's always...
Yeah, like leap day is a perfect example, right? Like you're just adding days to the calendar. So there's and in all these, there's calendars that are all over the world that do things slightly differently. The main problem with DST is that the whole world doesn't do DST at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have like a database, which is like, this is where the date for when it's going to change in this region. This is when it's going to change when you're in this region, then this locale, this locale. It'd be a lot saner if the whole world changed at the same time, but that's never going to happen. So you deal with it. But the people are like, oh, if DST was went away, we wouldn't have these problems. It's not true. There's calendars are weird in so many different ways. It would reoccur in different things. The onus is on Apple to get better testing and automated testing facilities that account for it. And I think they're getting better. But obviously, nobody's perfect. Yeah.
The main problem with DST is that we all want to say savings, and people want to correct and say saving, and it just sounds
wrong. I admit, my title originally
I saw that.
Said daylight savings time.
Yeah, I saw someone correct it, and I wasn't going to change it. I mean, to me, that's like, you know, people do the same thing with New Year's and like where the apostrophe goes, and it just like,
yeah.
Every year, who cares? Who cares? We also got the beta 3 versions of all the 0.1 updates that are coming out this week, including watchOS 5.1 beta 3, which we look forward to see. Is there the ECG app yet for Series 4 in the US? So you wouldn't be able to see that in the UK. But on my Series 4 watch, if it were there, I could see it, and it's not there yet. And part of me thinks that because of like the nature of what it is, it might not be in a beta until it's just like out. But maybe it will be, but it's not there yet. The thing that made me interested in this release is that it fixes a lot of the text clipping issues where there was text outside of what the safe area would be for like the corners of the grounded display. Now that the display is in a box with sharp corners. And on the 44 millimeter Series 4, you see this in the stand hour alerts. The time would be cut off. Now it's inset the right way. And then there were issues on the 40 millimeter too. I think there were a lot more there. And then you saw some of those fixed, right?
Yeah, they're getting through them.
Yeah, it's too bad because I don't think the iPhone had this kind of problem. It got more attention before it was released. But at least we're seeing, you know, this change. Other thing that we look for in these betas, at least for watchOS 5.1, is are they adding new complications to the infograph face? Because it's easily the biggest complaint about the Series 4, I think, is that the Infograph and Infograph Modular lack a lot of complications from Apple that are on other faces. And like Apple, you know, the company could put some people on it. And
like messages.
Yeah. And so far, they've not done that. And all of this makes us wonder, especially the ECG app being absent, is this actually going to be an October release, or might it come in early November? You know, and what might that mean for new iPads and an Apple event?
Yeah, I mean, it's already Thursday, yep. And we're kind of running out of time on invites for a like third week of October event. The ECG app being missing kind of implies to me, because all these betas are always baked like a beta ahead, so you're essentially already two behind. Like, if they wanted to release this on the third week, if they want to release the point ones on the third week of October, then what we're seeing now is basically what there's there. They're not going to add features most of the time. So to me, it's leaning towards the point ones come out in November, like maybe the middle of November or something.
Yeah. As far as like the date prediction goes, when I wrote a piece at the beginning of the month that was like, what are we, all the things that were looking to happen this month, I looked back at when the October event was the last time in 2016, and I just would have like imagined it being like the middle of October, like maybe around the 16th or 17th or even like 14th. But I think it was the 27th, so it was like almost the end of October for an event, which is kind of wild to think about, being that close to November and December. But because of that, I've gotten more comfortable with predicting that October 30th is what we're going to see this year, which would mean a few more weeks of no, you know, announcement. And it's just like almost all of October goes by, and we're just kind of waiting, and then finally at the very end it happens. So. But in terms of these updates, you know, maybe next week will be different, or in 2 weeks from now, we'll see. But we also saw iOS 12.1.0 come out, which watchOS 5.0.1 and tvOS, the essential tvOS 12.0.1, came out really fast after the big updates. But then the 12.0.1 for iOS 12 is really late. And it seems like maybe they're just kind of waiting, like picking up the number of bugs and fixing them all in one instead of having like a 0.2 and 0.3. But this fixed the iPhone XS charging issue, which some people said affected other iPhones and iPads, where the screen needed to be turned on, and then you plug in a lightning cable for a charge to be recognized in some cases. I never experienced this, but apparently it happened. Also an issue with Wi-Fi, where the XS would get stuck on the wrong version of your Wi-Fi network. You know,
yeah, wrong frequency.
Yeah, and so they've resolved that. And then the big thing is that the number key, the number and punctuation key on the iPad, it got moved in iOS 12 beta, and it shipped that way, and it was like swapped with where the emoji key is. And they did one release like that, and everyone was upset about it, and then they put it right back where it was.
Yeah, like all the other ones are kind of weird bugs, right? And then this one's must have been a design change. Like, it was there from the first beta of iOS 12, and they kept it for the entire time. And then as soon as it comes to the public, like, this is probably wrong, we'll change it back next time. It was like, I don't really understand how this one wasn't changed earlier in the cycle, but Apple is weird sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what they were going for the first time. Like, were they trying to match the iPhone keyboard and landscape or something? Even with that on the 10 style phones, the emoji key is like floating aside in the distance in the gray area.
I would maybe guess that the keyboard on these new upcoming iPads is redesigned in some way. Maybe they have like full height arrow keys or something, you know, like some difference, and that this was a consequence of that.
Oh.
And for whatever reason, nobody came around and cleaned it up before it came out.
Could just be like on the iPhone where it's got emoji and dictation floating on either side. And like the...
Yeah, if they have a home indicator, then they probably will do something like that, right? Where they jot it down. And if they do that, it'd be kind of cool if they could fill some of the... Because obviously on the iPad, they're going to have a lot more width to deal with. So they could... Some of those like cut, copy and paste buttons, they have on like this toolbar above, they could put it down, maybe. Like, there's some flexibility there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whenever I upgrade my iPad, I'm going to give up my split keyboard, because I've got the 9.7-inch iPad Pro, and you can still do a split keyboard. But on the 10.5-inch and larger, it's always been absent. So I guess I'll have to give that up. They should do that again. That was a good idea. Because you like type, you hold the iPad in two hands, and you type with your thumbs on either side of the screen, even if it's in like, you know, landscape mode. So they should bring that back. And the one thing that they've changed that everyone hates, including you, and I've gotten used to, but it's I'll agree that it's bad, is the photo picker and messages. being an iMessage app, they put it in, you know, down in the app like carousel, and it requires more taps to get to than it used to. And so a lot of people tap the camera now, and they put a little photo button up there too, so you can like tap through But I admit it's
and then like, even if you tap through, you don't have to press all photos because the iMessage app starts small. No, it doesn't start small. It doesn't start big. It's, I don't know.
Yeah, so.
It's creaky.
I get why they made it an iMessage app, but I mean, even if it was like long press the camera to get to photos, it'd be better because a lot of times that little tray isn't there or it's like in the wrong spot. So yeah,
you know, I thought if you press on the camera and then it comes up with that grid, and obviously in the top left it has the button to go to the photo library,
right?
If you press that button, it should make the button on the bar the photo library, and then when you go in the photo library there'd be a button to go back to the camera.
Yeah,
so that means if you're always using the selfie camera, it always stays a selfie camera, but if you're always using the photo library, it'd always be a photo library.
Yeah, wasn't that when iOS 12.0 came out, like on Twitter, that was one of the easily searchable complaints, was like, where are the new emoji, which are in 12.1, and then like, why is this moved?
Yeah. And I think rivaling it for worst change in iOS 12 is the FaceTime redesign with the flip camera button getting buried behind. Like, that's definitely annoying people. I Twitter searched that one over the weekend, and there were some funny replies.
Yeah, my wife FaceTimes her mom, who only lives like in the town over, but they FaceTime all the time, like just in the evening. It's like their version of a phone call. And I saw in you know real time that play out where she's like, "How do I change this?" And like they kept hanging up and calling back, like fix
the. And the thing that kills me is that when you open the extras menu that shows the option to flip, the preview of your camera is hidden. You can't see it anymore. So when you press flip, you don't have any feedback of the thumbnail actually changing to show you the other camera. You just have to press it and then dismiss it. And then you're like, oh, it's done it. It's bad.
Yeah, it is not good yet. which they should address that. So that's the 12.0.1, and maybe there will be more. But in this
area, and neither the messages or the FaceTime problems are addressed in the betas either.
Right. And one more, this is what I was thinking of. I was going to mention this. And FaceTime, that you can't take a live photo anymore of the other person. People complain about that too. Yeah. It's like it barely got mentioned all beta cycle. Like you noticed it, and I just hadn't thought of it. But then that was one of the things that you could like search for, and people were complaining about. Because people care. It's like you're on the phone, you can take a screenshot, which I've done as like a memory of a call with someone who isn't here anymore. Or you can take a live photo, which is like, I guess, like a better quality plus the UI of the call, including you. You know, you're not in the frame.
Yeah, that's the main benefit, is you don't get the stupid Chrome in the way.
Yeah. Yeah, and it isn't like a privacy issue. Like it flashes their screen. I think maybe there's even a control for it, but yeah, it's gone. Mm. But we do have some news about iOS 12 adoption. So tell me about how it's being rolled out and accepted.
Yeah, so this is pretty encouraging news if you're Apple, in that iOS 12 has reached the 50% threshold for installed on active devices about a month faster than iOS 11 did. In the first couple of days of iOS 12 being out, it was actually slower adoption rate than iOS 11, but there's a mixed panel chart. There's Apple's official stats, which say 50%, and also Mixpanel, which is a third-party analytics company. They do their own charts as well, and both of them are now saying it's above 50. And you can actually see on the Mixpanel graph, they do like day by day, whereas Apple just updates every 2 weeks. On the day by day, it kind of coasts along, and then almost to the exact 7 days after it comes out, it then suddenly spikes upwards. And so I believe that after the 7 days goes by is when Apple really starts sending out the notifications to the user base. So until then, it's kind of like word of mouth, you install from the settings. And then after about a week, they start really pushing it with the notifications, and that's caused it to skyrocket. Mm-hmm. And overtake iOS 11 by about a month, which is clearly at least partly driven by how good I think iOS 12 has been received overall in terms of performance on older devices. No clear buggy problems, really. People are generally quite happy about it. And someone, when I posted this story, said that, oh, it's obvious that iOS 12 is higher because the new phones came out and they require, if you get a new Apple Watch, you have to be on iOS 12 to use it. But that was the same last year as well. Like, well, the new phones came out.
One thing I would say about the year-over-year compare with devices is that no devices were dropped. So there are technically more devices capable of running. But that doesn't mean – I think this relies a lot on people to update, not just, like, how many are sold. Yeah. But they've also got a new stat this year. Like, they're not just saying how many are on 12. They're saying how many are on 12 in the last – that or devices introduced in the last 4 years. which is a
that is new compare. Interesting. So that means that they have one for all devices that access the App Store, and then one for iPhone 6 and later, which is a, roughly encompasses all the devices that run OS 12, but then you have some iPads, and then you have the iPhone 5S that isn't included. So it's not imminently clear why they chose a four-year cutoff versus like a five-year cutoff. I think the best thing I can think of is that on the 2013, i.e. 5 years ago, that was a lineup where they had the iPhone 5S, which can get iOS 12, and the iPhone 5C, which can't. Mm-hmm. So if they included that, then their numbers would look worse because the 5C users can't update past iOS 10. So they're always going to be dragging down the numbers of adoption. But it is kind of weird out of the blue now they're suddenly adding a four-year stat. So we'll have to keep our eyes on that. Like, maybe they change it and it becomes 5 years next year when they can encompass the updates. It's a bit strange.
Yeah, yeah.
Or maybe it's like a subtle hint that they're planning 4 years of support for devices.
I wonder what the number would have been if they would have said in the last 5 years to include the 5S.
5C.
Well, 5C, but also like 5S, like from that year.
Because that just gets discounted, doesn't it?
Lower than the 50% number, you know.
But then all devices is 50%.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's not even a massive differential. So all devices is 50%, and then devices since September 2014 is 53%. So it's only a 3% differential at the moment. Like, I'm surprised they even broke it down at all. But that's definitely one to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, so people are updating. Yeah, that's good. I saw with my own family, like I used to tell them like go update today. All this new stuff's there, and then I realized that that's just like asking to volunteer with tech support. You know, if there are any problems, then I'll I'm the person that made the problem happen. So I've not done that in a long, long time. And I almost did it with my dad. I was like, he's got some older devices. I think an iPhone 6 and like an older iPad. And I was like, you should update your stuff. It'll be faster. You know, this is a bit that makes it better. And he'd mentioned that everything had a storage problem. Like, he needed more storage to update, which was an issue that I thought they'd fix a while ago with, like, offloading your apps. And part of me wondered if he was mistaken for the 5 GB iCloud, you know, error, which I can see why people, like, you can have a massive iPhone, but if you don't pay for iCloud storage, you're gonna get an alert about your storage running out all the time, and to know what the difference is, you've got to be informed. So he said that, and I don't think he uses a computer, so I couldn't say like plug up to iTunes and do it that way, because then you bypass the storage problem, I think.
Yeah, the storage situation has gotten better. And that they do, like, they'll delete your apps and re-download them afterwards. Yeah. And the overall requirement is also a lower size. But if your phone is still very, very full, it will still require you to delete some space. Like, they just reduced the requirement of low space, not got rid of it altogether.
Yeah. And then my stepmom had mentioned that her phone was just giving her problems. Like, she wasn't receiving messages that people were sending and stuff like that. And I looked at it and I was like, oh, that's okay. I can update it and it'll be a lot better. Because I knew it was old. But then I realized it was in a case, and I looked at it closer, and it was a 5C, and I was like, oh, this can't be updated at all. And it isn't even like the 5C, like when it was new. I think it's like a later version. I had 8 GB of data, like brand new, and part of that was the OS, and then the rest of it was like content, and it showed like 0 GB available, like zero kilobytes available. It's like there's – and it was like on 10 point whatever. And there is nothing to be done to it. So I didn't mention it. I just gave it back to her. But
talking of messages not sending stuff, there's an interesting case of unintended consequences with iOS 12 that slight sidetrack, but I'll just,
because
I'm tracking this story. But there's a feature in iOS 12 where messages combines threads from like your phone number and your email address. So if you accidentally send and receive from different addresses, they don't appear as three different contacts in your messages list. It combines it into one, which is a great feature, right? Like it sounds like what you want. But there's actually a problem, or there's a problem in how it's working, in that, yes, you're supposed to use family sharing, or yes, you're supposed to all have separate Apple IDs, right? But today, a lot of families are from the pre-family sharing era, and they would just share Apple IDs and just live it and just do it that way, right? They'd all share like a same Apple ID and just go on with their life.
Yeah.
And up to now, it hasn't really been a problem. Like, there is some weirdness in that some preferences all sync across all of them and blah, blah, blah. But you could set your iCloud, like, you could just use iCloud through your phone number. Sorry, iMessage through your phone number and just talk to people that way and technically share an iCloud ID. If you, and you maybe share photos or you, but that now has an issue on iOS 12 because iOS 12 will try and combine the threads from the different addresses that share the same account. So say if I'm, let's assume that you're stupid, right? And you haven't done this properly.
Okay.
So you've got you and your wife, right?
Yeah.
And I send a message to you. Well, but I have both you and your wife in my contacts, right?
Uh-huh.
It will combine the threads of you and your wife into one. So I can't actually talk to you. It will send it to your wife if you are sharing Apple IDs.
The way I saw this was like if my iPhone uses my phone number and then my daughter's iPad uses my emails like the send from, and like I never send from my emails like the send from messages ID, even though they're connected. I can receive on both sides, but I don't send from it. And all of a sudden, like my daughter and me, we get combined in a way that like fixes a loop that's been open for a long time. And like it was in the splash screen as like an update, and people were like, "Finally, I thought it worked that way before. Or it was supposed to work that way before." But all of a sudden, because we were like, because I didn't make an ID for her to start with, she was just using one of mine, like a version of mine that was connected but not like assigned as like the send from. Then we get squished together.
And it means that the person that cannot fix the problem, i.e. the person talking to you, then gets their messages redirected to a different person than what they intended. Because I can't make you, like, I can't do anything to stop it from happening, right?
Right.
I have to wait for you to sort your account information out. So as the person who's just sending a text, it's like your personal, it's like your personal phone is just sending text to the wrong people. That's what it seems, you know, and people complain about it on the message boards. And it seems like in every case, it's this issue where people aren't actually using family sharing, they're sharing IDs, and there isn't a great way to fix it yet, apart from just hope that everybody gets their own IDs.
Yeah. So the fix then is to set up family sharing, you know, you as the parent, and then create IDs for your kids, if that's the problem, or your spouse, partner. And before family sharing, there was an issue where you had to fudge the birthday to make someone that's under 13 an account. And with family sharing, you can create a child account, which is then like their correct birthday, but then it's tied to that family sharing account until they turn 13, I think. But like my daughter's 5, and so she has an Apple ID from before family sharing, which probably has the birthday as like mine or something. And then my son is 1, and just for the, you know, sake of family sharing completion, I've had an account for him, you know, have his email ready when he's old enough to use one. And it shows up as a child. And I think I couldn't like remove family sharing without like removing the child or something. Like it's really weird language the way it works.
There are a lot of restrictions on what you can exactly do with managing your family sharing accounts and stuff.
Yeah, but that's the thing though, right? Is to make family sharing a thing and then create brand new identities for the people that were using like the extension of yours. Which one of the people that were experiencing this problem, like I think they have 2 daughters, and it was the dad, and he would use that solution to message the 2 of them. So like maybe he had a phone number and like 2 other IDs associated with that. It just sounds like a big mess, and it's one of those things where I wouldn't want to be experiencing it, and it pays to be informed on what's happening here.
I said before, like, pretend like you're the one being stupid. I don't mean that these people are stupid, right? Like,
no,
they're just
totally
doing
normal.
What always worked, and now they're not following exactly what you're supposed to do. But before, Apple never really trained people exactly what to do. Like,
well,
the options were there, they just weren't used. And so now I think Apple's in a bit of a mess. Like,
yeah,
I'm not sure how they're going to fix this.
The iMessage thing has had years of iteration of like getting it where it needs to be. I mean, before iMessage in the cloud, you know, there was a period for a long time on iMessage where, you know, it was cool from the iPhone, but if you use it on the Mac, it always came from your email address, like by default, even though your phone came from your phone number. And I think you could change it always maybe, but like the one thing to do was always send from your email address, and then it would be the same thread everywhere, including your iPhone. And then they made it where it was easier to join those threads. And then I think the Mac was better at combining threads and the phone wasn't, and now the phone is. So it's not the people's fault. It's definitely the implementation has been years. Come on, it's wasn't it iOS 5? So now in 12, they've closed all of the loops, and people are suffering because of that, in some cases.
Yeah, so now these little edge cases are all popping up of, it's a classic case of unintended consequences of how is this a bad feature? But then you think about it, and all these people are kind of abusing the Apple ID system in weird ways, and it ends up looking like your iPhone can't send text reliably anymore. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Mixed with the fact that when family sharing was introduced a few years ago, it was not good at first. It was actually really bad. Yeah. And it got better over the span of a year. But I know for me, I had to do a lot of tech support for my family for issues that I was causing. It was hey, we can share.
Yeah, and I guarantee now there are thousands of people who are doing clean factory restores of their own iPhone because they can't text someone else when the solution is all on the other person's end, but they have no way of knowing about it. It's a big issue.
Yeah, the early issues with family sharing I recall were you couldn't update your apps for a while, the other person that was now had access to your apps that you paid for, they couldn't update the free apps and stuff like that. And then whenever it became required, if you wanted to share Apple Music, then they improved it, but it took a while. So, yeah. Let's talk about a change with Apple Music and Lyrics and the Service Genius. So tell me what's new there.
Yeah, so today they announced a partnership. Apple and Genius are kind of working together in a couple of different ways. So the Genius is a lyrics, trivia, music fan site, essentially, for all these different songs. And they have community curated lyrics of everything and little facts and information.
Yeah, it used to be called Rap Genius. And then streamlined into just Genius and became about all media and genres. And
yeah, unrelated to iTunes Genius.
Yeah, or the Genius Bar. and the thing I know Genius for is annotating, which I think maybe at one point it was the history is correcting lyrics, but also the meanings behind stuff.
Yeah, so that you can click on a line and it will tell you what they're trying to say and stuff.
Yeah, with context, right? Yeah.
Yeah, so what Apple's doing here is on the Genius app and on their website, Genius is now embedding an Apple Music player. So you can actually play the song from the Genius site without having to open iTunes or anything. This is essentially the music kit on the web stuff that Apple announced at WWDC. Mm-hmm. So anyone can do this. You don't have to have a partnership, but obviously it seems like as part of this, Apple got them to do it. And then on the flip side, Apple will now use Genius to improve their lyrics for their Apple Music library. Yep. So since iOS 10, you've been able to get lyrics in as long as you have an Apple Music subscription. And now some, they say thousands of songs will now be sourced through the Genius database rather than whatever else they were using.
Yeah, and rewind a minute. If you're on the web, I guess, or in the Genius app, and you see the embed for Apple Music, the player, if you're signed out, you just get a preview, right? And if you're signed in,
yeah, the 30-second song preview.
Yeah, and if you're signed in, you get you've got a membership. You get the full song on the web, or in the app, which is neat. The thing about the in-app thing, yeah, so you mentioned thousands of songs, an unknown number, but not millions. And Apple says they have over 50 million songs, so it's some fraction of songs. We just don't know which ones. And this seems like it's definitely a partnership where they've made a deal, but I've not seen Apple really push this yet, and it's Genius announced it. But it was unclear at first, if it's just Genius is using the embed player and that's it. But then it became clear to us the closer we looked at it, that also the Apple Music app will have lyrics sourced from Genius. I guess that weren't there before or that weren't good sources. But the thing about it is, we mentioned the annotation stuff, and I don't think any of that's in the Apple Music side. It's just the copy.
Correct.
Of lyrics.
It's just the plain text view of lyrics. They're not adding the trivia stuff. They're not adding any of the context. You won't even know that these lyrics are from Genius because Apple doesn't put it. It's not like Maps where they put TomTom and little logos in the corner.
Yeah.
The lyric screen is just lyrics and that's it. There's no attribution.
Right. Yeah. Huh.
Which is probably why Apple's not announcing it, right? Because I don't think they kind of want you to even know about it. It's just hey, there's some lyrics you'd better. And the fraction of the songs thing is kind of funny, like, statistic. Like, it sounds like, well, if there's only a few thousand of, like, 50 million songs, then it's not going to matter. But I think Genius tends to be leaning on, like, popular songs a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And most, like, I'd bet, like, 95% of people who use Apple Music listen to the same pool of, like, 20,000 songs. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just because it's just what's in the charts and, you know, the classic hits and stuff. So if Apple can get higher, better accuracy, lyrics, because I've definitely seen some cases before where the lyrics provided by Apple Music are mostly correct, but then there's some like weird gaps or just some of the words are wrong, and Genius likes to say that they have really accurate lyrics. So if they can just make them better, then, you know, it's just a nice improvement to the user experience without the customer having to change anything at all.
Yeah, the secret to lyrics is that no one knows the real lyrics, no matter what. Like, even the liner notes on albums can be incorrect, and live performances can vary from like recordings. So it's like it's such a hard thing to do. Like, you could source from the record label, but then even then you might have errors. You know, it's a hard thing.
And lyrics in Apple Music at the moment are pretty trivial. Like, what I want them to do is what kind of Shazam offers on a lot of their songs, where you get like line by line as the song goes on, it can highlight where you are in the track in the view, like synchronized to the music.
Yeah, that would be nice. And in Shazam, which Apple has, you know, finished their acquisition of, you've got to tag the song actively. So even if you know the song, like what it is, you're playing it from your library, you call it up with your voice, for example, you've still got to tag it to get that, you know, to work. And this would be nice, like, if it just worked like that in the music app. But the other thing is, like, lyrics, you know, they're just text files. It isn't like they're photos or videos or the songs themselves. So, like, they're very small in terms of, like, data size. But Apple seems to call them up on the spot. Like, as you scroll to that area, they will load in. It isn't like they're just, like, you add the song to your library and the lyrics are attached to it. And if you're offline, then they're there for you. I think it's every time you look for a lyric, it loads it in on the fly.
That's certainly what it seems like, because you get a little spinner for like a second or two before it actually does it.
Which almost seems like a licensing issue that they have to do that and not saving offline lyrics or something. You know, I wonder if this has an effect on that or if it's just an implementation detail that they haven't, you know, sorted out yet.
It could have been because it wasn't there from the start.
Yeah,
and it was added, you know, because Apple Music started like iOS 8 and then it was added in iOS 10, and wherever the lyrics come from is like separate from what provides the songs. And it was just the easiest way to do it. Like, I will just do a separate request when you ask to see them.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of like maps, too, where if you get corrections, it's easier to fix it that way. I just load in every time. But, so we got some progress there. People really like Genius. And so this is overall, like, positive received story. It's just the murkiness of, like, you know, finding... I guess we'll just have to see, like, do people know which songs have lyrics and which don't? And do they see corrections? You know, we'll just, like, watch and see what happens here. Yeah.
And I tell you what, Apple Music has been making a lot of small partnerships like this quite often in the last few months. Like, they've done this weird, like, Ministry of Sound partnership in the UK. They've got this Genius thing. They have these partnerships with, like, the BAFTAs and stuff every now and again. Like, they're definitely trying to push that as far as they can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, let's talk about Apple Pay for a moment. A few weeks ago at Apple's earnings call, I believe it was, Tim Cook had said in like part of his prepared remarks that Apple Pay was coming to CVS for the first time, which historically CVS has had the hardware to accept Apple Pay, contactless payments over NFC, but they put in the effort to disable it in favor of a myth, an imagined form of payment called CurrentC that never actually launched. So then you had to do, you know, swipe your debit card or put the chip in and wait for it to beep and you know, put in the code. And so when they announced this change, it was like finally, because CurrentC had been dead for ages. And there was no reason that CVS, you know, a very popular drugstore in the U.S., wouldn't take Apple Pay, especially when they had the hardware. Walgreens has accepted Apple Pay from day one, and they're a close competitor. But so finally, Apple Pay works at CVS. And this was, you know, like I said, it was announced a few weeks ago as a thing coming, like, within the quarter. And then last week or so, people like Ben Beharin had tested it and reported on Twitter that they were able to use Apple Pay at CVS. But for me personally, I was very skeptical to try it just because I'd tried and failed before when I thought it might work. And it almost felt like CVS was off limits. It's like in the early days when Apple Pay was like semi rolled out in some places where it should work. It didn't. It was a little bit embarrassing. Well, today Apple sent out a big marketing email to people who are on the mailing list for things like this. And the big Apple Pay news this week was finally accepted at CVS officially. So you can shop at CVS and use Apple Pay in confidence, and it shouldn't fail. That's a good thing. Yeah, I don't think they've got like the rewards card in the same way yet with the wallet app, which yeah. Walgreens does, and it used to be like the scan it thing, and then whenever iOS got the feature, they added where you wave it, just like with Apple Pay, and that's really cool. You do two taps for pay or two taps for like reward and then pay. So CVS has some catching up there to do, I believe, but it's progress. 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by Zender, makers of the Passport Pro, the ultimate global travel adapter. 9 to 5 Mac and Zender have teamed up to give away a brand new iPhone XS Max that retails for $10.99 new, and Zender is giving Happy Hour listeners special pre-order pricing on Passport Pro. This month, Zender launched Passport Pro, the ultimate global travel adapter, with one USB-C port for power delivery and three USB-A outputs. The adapter works in over 200 countries and regions and comes in a 16% smaller design than the company's original Passport travel adapter. Passport Pro is the world's first with a ground connection for added safety and a push-button resettable fuse that makes it as safe as possible for you and your devices as you travel. Sign up for the iPhone XS Max giveaway on 9to5mac.com and check out Passport Pro. Entries are open through October 17th, 2018. All right, Mayo, it's been a big week for smart screen speaker things.
Yeah, everyone loves to call them speakers, but almost all of them have screens now.
Yeah. So I'll go through the list of the new ones here that are announced this week or recently. This week we get Facebook Portal, which is an interesting thing. Google Home Hub, is that right?
Yep.
Okay, I wrote that from memory, but I wasn't sure. And then Echo Show, which is the second version of that. That's the name of it, right? It's the small TV.
Echo Show 2.
Yeah, Echo Show 2. The Facebook Portal from memory is a 10-inch screen that you can have vertical or portrait, flip it around, has a camera.
You've already gone wrong.
No?
The 10-inch one is only landscape.
Okay. Oh, and then there's a 15-inch version called Portal Plus that you can rotate.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a big screen.
that is massive.
But they're not like super high res or anything. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's decent. I think it's 1080p, but...
Yeah, meant to be used at a distance, I think, hands-free. But they've got Facebook voice control. They've got a camera with a physical cover. They've got a mode that disables the camera and microphone. And then they also have Amazon Alexa built in for, like, everything that isn't call somebody on Messenger, I think.
Is that about right? Yeah, and and they don't have an app store or anything, so it's only limited to what's provided as like a stock app. It's kind of like the old Apple TV model before the TVS stuff. It's like, you've got these 10 channels you can use, but critically, there's no Netflix at the moment. There's no YouTube, which is kind of an important apps for, like a 15-inch screen. Like, what are you going to watch on it if you can't get Netflix or YouTube?
Yeah, they have Facebook Watch, which, I don't know. I mean,
they have a cooking channel, I think.
Yeah. Facebook Watch is, I think they got a thing called Newsy or something too. But Facebook Watch is like it's on Apple TV as well, and you can look at that and see what's on there. But I don't think people are buying this for that. This thing got dinged pretty heavily and like dismissed in the tech press because of all the privacy issues. I mean, just a few weeks ago, Facebook had a big breach. It's like bad timing, but there is some intelligent stuff here, like the video calling stuff. It can pan and zoom on its own. Like if there's one person in the room and a second person enters, it can zoom out to include both people. And then if you're over there and you speak, the microphone can try and intelligently like focus on who's speaking at the moment to enhance the audio, right?
Yeah. And if you're like cooking, you can be washing up and then you go back to the counter and the camera can do a pretty good job of following you around.
Yeah, so it's not just try and do the whole room in this big bubble, but it zooms in on you or you and someone else if they enter the room. It zooms out.
Yeah, and you are still butting up against the physical problems of the angles, right? Like it's a decent lens, but it's not super wide angle. So you're not going to be able to do like a 360 and it follow you around. It's right. kind of like a 90 degree pan, essentially. And if yeah. you, and if two people come in, it will kind of accommodate that and stuff.
I think the full field of view is like not quite 180, but 140. So like almost everything in front of it, but not quite. Which I guess
yeah,
the
that's
other,
sorry, yeah, that sounds about right.
The other 40 degrees is probably like the super distorted part of a bubble anyway. So that part of it is like, you know, it makes it stand out and it's intelligent, but you know, like other cameras could add that. It isn't, you know, Facebook exclusive. The Facebook part of it is it's focused around Messenger video calling. But then aside from that, like you can't look, like you said, you can't look at Facebook on it. I don't think you can send messages with Facebook on it.
No text messaging.
Yeah. And yeah, but they did have like Pandora and Spotify, I think. So if you, that's where they get the speaker part of it, I guess. But.
Yeah. And it's unclear how good or bad the speakers are. It's definitely meant to be video chat first.
Yeah, and I think the pricing is like $200 for the smaller 10-inch version and then $350 like HomePod price for the big 15-inch version.
Yeah.
What do you think about this? Comes out in November. Yeah.
I didn't like the initial, like, people who were kind of just dismissing it because, hey, it's Facebook, la, 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 yeah. privacy, ha, ha, ha. Yeah. Like, people use Facebook every day. Like, any service now, most services in the world still uses your data for bad things and they don't protect it very well. But I think the video chat is kind of like sort of neat, but I think all of these smart speaker, quote unquote, with screens have just ergonomics problems where it's like you have to put them in one place. It's a struggle to even find a place in your home where you can put them in like a communal area, mm-hmm. like especially the 15 inch one. You can't just put it next to your... I love there was a press marketing failure from Facebook where it was just sitting next to the bread bin and like the salt shaker. It's like, yeah, we'll just put this 15-inch screen in the middle of it. It'll completely blend in. Like, it's so hard to find a place in most people's houses in like the living room or the kitchen where they can put one of these and it doesn't make the room ugly. It doesn't draw your eye too much, but also it's in a place where you can actually use it efficiently, right? Yeah. Like, the problem with the ones with screens is that they're intrusive. Like you, they demand a line of sight to them, whereas something like an Echo cylinder or a HomePod, you can just put it in the corner on like a cabinet or on a shelf and, you know, the sound travels. You don't have to look at it.
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest problem with these things. And even if you look specifically at the video chat stuff, if you're stuck in one place, yes, it can pan and zoom around a bit, but you tend to walk more than 140 degrees. I find when I'm on a call, I don't pace around the room sometimes. And it's like, if I was on FaceTime, you know, I'm holding the phone in my hand. I can angle it however I want just by tilting my hand. I can walk around. And if someone's doing something funny that I'm looking at, I can flip the camera really easily, iOS 12 notwithstanding, and show them my perspective. Like, with these fixing place kiosk screens, I just think they're more limiting than having like a family iPad on a portrait stand. Like,
yeah, the privacy stuff aside, the thing that this feels like it's competing with is FaceTime, and that's to say like that FaceTime dominates in video calling space. Like, you know, Skype is you know, historically like what we used to use for video calling, but like FaceTime is just built in as part of your contacts anyway, like part of the phone app. It's everywhere on your Apple devices at least, and I've had people. Family members like switch to the iPhone, not for the camera, but so that they can FaceTime. And it's like, you could do Skype already or like lots of other things, you know, Hangouts that
Facebook are, that Messenger video chat on the app.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like everyone has Facebook and you could do Messenger video chat. But like my sister, for example, she lives farther away than a lot of my other family. And so she bought an iPhone for FaceTime. It's like, and she had a Samsung Galaxy phone, a pretty new one. But I guess it was just like, it's easier that way. And my family all says FaceTime for video call. So Apple's done some good things there. And you know, this is not like a new category of things. It's like the latest version of one of these kind of like screen things with an assistant and a camera. And I think that Facebook has a really bad history with hardware, like as popular as Facebook itself is, the service that people don't like Facebook for the hardware. There was a phone that was Facebook branded and there was this like Facebook home launcher and like those things are all you know, I'll say it's stupid. This might have a chance of being better than that. And the only reason I say that is because I can see it being used in the same way that the Echo Show and Spot, the little circle camera, have been useful for people in my family that have FaceTime, but that the advantage of something like the Spot is that it's voice control. Like every interaction can be voice control, and the drop-in feature where you don't have to have the other person answer. You just like say call, and then it can like just like tap into their stream. And as long as you have like the expectations of how that works and, you know, manage on and off, I guess, then that can be a very useful thing, especially for older people. And to say like, you know, this is your chair where you watch TV a lot, you know, in the evenings, and this is your Echo Spot, you know, and you can have it answer trivia and play music and call me, and and I can call you, and it will just answer for you. You don't have to like figure out is your hand over the camera, you know, and is your face far enough away from it? Like, it's aiming at your chair where you will be. And that's not ideal for us. Like, ergonomically, the phone is just going to win every time. But I think for older people, it has some advantages. And older people don't – it's not that they don't care about privacy, but, like, the platform itself is just, you know, it can be mind-blowing in that privacy is just, like, not even in the conversation. It's just, like, you know –
Well, like, everyone goes on about how, you know, everyone cares about privacy these days, but, you know, there's not mass exoduses of these services. Like, everyone still uses Facebook, Twitter, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, Facebook has like 1.5 billion customers or even more than that. It's like, yes, it's kind of like a nice bonus when they you're using a company that does respect your privacy, like Apple generally. But I think it's pretty clear that the market picks based on features and functions, not, oh, my data is really secure here. It's like, It's not what happens.
Yeah, it's really trendy in the tech circles to, you know, be more sophisticated and take inventory of like privacy. And that's why people love Apple. But if you're just looking at it in terms of like, where are the users? Like, my family isn't on Twitter, and the way Twitter works, you know, we have enough complaints about that on its own, but the way it works is like not the way that my family would use it. And it's like Facebook, you know, whether it's Facebook, Instagram, you know, WhatsApp, the various things that they acquire, there are people there that are not on other services or it's in a different way. So yeah, I mean, I am with you there, and that won't be like a popular thing to say within our circles, but I think the user data speaks for itself, is that people have not left Facebook en masse. They've not done something so bad yet that people have done that.
And you don't see droves of Samsung users migrating to the iPhone because of privacy. Like,
yeah,
they might do it because they like how the iPhone looks or an emoji, but you don't hear people like raving from the rooftops about security, really.
Or leaving iCloud because of, like, you know, people got, you know, doing the exploit years ago, the exploit leaked some personal photos of celebrities. It's like,
yeah.
And we can understand how that happened. And it wasn't like necessarily a duh flaw, but like, you know, it happened.
Yeah, it was like social engineering, wasn't it?
Right,
like,
indeed. So,
and people laugh it off and then everyone carries on.
Yeah. And this whole thing is like, why would Facebook have the guts to put this thing out? Like, what's the point of it? You know, but if you just like watch like sci-fi movies and stuff in the future, like, this idea of like a fixed screen that you talk to and can call someone, like, it's not, I don't think it's a stupid idea. I think there's some merit to it. When I think about it being more tech savvy, it's not for me. Like, I'm not going to buy one of these, and I've got an Echo Spot and like that. And it's just like,
I think if you want a kitchen screen, it has to have YouTube. Like, sure. YouTube is so important. And at the moment, the only way to get one of these smart screens that have them is to get the Google product, because they block Amazon from putting on the Echo Show, and Facebook doesn't offer it either. So on that basis alone, I think the best option is the Home Hub.
Yeah.
Or one of the other, because Google has like third parties that have Google Assistant built in and stuff, yeah. So you could get a different one. But they're going
to
push the
Home Hub. We'll discuss it in a moment. Like, these things, I think, to us being more savvy, they compete with iPads. And they like really, really, you know, the iPad's about to get a big makeover that makes it look way more modern than all these things, and it already does anyway.
Yeah, it's like if you go to the, you know, grandma for doing video call stuff, it's like, would you buy your relatives for Christmas a photo frame essentially that can only be in one place, or would you just get them an iPad that can do FaceTime and so much other stuff? Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
It's a hard sell. It really is. That's my problem. I love the idea. I love visual interfaces, right? Like, the idea of smart screens being ubiquitous across the whole place is compelling in my mind, but none of these hardware options at the moment really seem to fit the bill for me. They're just so ugly or intrusive or just not very useful yet. Yeah. Like, they're just always beaten for me by a watch or a phone or an iPad. Like, even the smart speakers, right? Everyone acts now in the tech world like smart speakers, everyone has them. It's like, no, they sell like 30 million a year total across everybody. Mm. And a lot of them are the really cheap ones that you get for Christmas. And that's fine, right? Like, there's nothing wrong with that. But these aren't like, people act as if they're in every home in the country, and it's just not true. And the smart screens are even smaller fraction of that.
Yeah, the thing about the iPad, like, I really feel like maybe Apple, you know, Apple probably doesn't need one of these things of their own. Like, you know, they have the iPad, and it starts at a pretty good price at $329, which is cheaper than one of the versions of the Facebook portals. But the iPad, the thing is, the voice control, like, it all is about Siri and, like, how well Siri is and how much people like Siri. But I think the missing thing there is being able to do everything with Siri, like very easily saying, you know, Siri, call Zach, Siri, hang up, Siri, leave a message, like supernatural language for everything that you can do with touch, like never.
Yeah, you can't be hands free.
Right. Like, even with the watch, you can't be yet. And it feels like there's like this week alone, I've got my kids in the bath, and like, I get a ding that I have an email on my phone. And so I say to the watch, Siri, open mail. And it's like, oh, there's the list of emails, but I still have to tap it to get to the one that's new. You know, stuff like that. It's like Siri is voice control for like launching apps and doing actions, but it's not everything that you can do in touch yet. And there was that.
You can't rumor, navigate the operating system just by speaking.
Right. And there was the rumor, like, even if it's like down one, left, right, you know. You can't do that. And there was a rumor from Mark Gurman maybe over a year ago that was...
It was like 3 years ago now.
Yeah, it was like Project Invisible Hand or something.
Yep.
And it was about that, about Apple working on a version of Siri that can do everything, I think.
I believe it was 2015 report, and Mark actually said Apple plans to launch this within 3 years. So...
Getting close.
I don't think that one came to fruition, unfortunately, because we are going to end 2018. Definitely with not a major Siri change.
Yeah, not yet. And then the next thing we have here is the Google Home Hub, which, again, I didn't look super close at this thing. You seem to be more keen on it during the keynote, and then afterwards the demos, like, killed it for you.
Yeah, it's fine. Like, I have the same problems with the Home Hub, the show, and just in terms of, you know, where you put them without them being ugly. Like, to me, they all look like the checkout kiosks when you do like self-service to buy your groceries. It's just like, people don't want that in the house. Like, you can put an iPad on the kitchen table, you can take it up to the bedroom, you can take it out of the house with you. They generally synchronize just so much better with your other stuff. Like, if you already have an iPhone, like, if as an iPhone family, it's just so much more of a pain to set up these things with, like, and you have to get separate apps to download. You have to log in with these accounts. You have to manage all this stuff. Like, the voice only stuff is way more compelling. Like, you can put it out the way. It can do stuff for you. It can do timers. You can play some music through it. And then if you're not a HomePod, you can do like multiple accounts with different family members and stuff. Like, the screens, to me, it's like everybody wants to have their own screen, and you can get that through your phone or an iPad. Like, whereas the voice is like more of the voice only speakers kind of just feel like more shared products. They just fit better, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, it's hard to describe, but
they blend better because there's no like focal point of where they are. They're everywhere for you within range.
Yeah,
and screens are like, you've got to have it in focus.
Yeah, like, I think a company would probably do better if they, like, integrated with the TV. And some people are starting to do this, but, like, because obviously most people in the living rooms have TVs, right? So the TVs are in the corner already. Like, it's de facto conclusion. But if you could say, like, hey, Amazon, show me the weather, and then the TV can just show it, and then, or the TV starts playing music by itself. Because the TV screen's huge, right? Like, you don't have to cower over and see this little 10-inch thing. You can be in the kitchen, and as long as you're at sight, you can see the TV. Like, I can't see people buying kiosk screens that sit on their like countertops when they're making food. Like everyone's like, oh, we'll put all these recipes on here. It's like, it just doesn't happen. I think they're very optimistic about what people use them for, and then nobody does.
Yeah. Can I say that Facebook portal, it sounds like kind of a geeky name, portal, but I think that's a much better description of like what it is than Google Home Hub. Like if I'm just looking at this, I don't really know what Google Home Hub is. Is it like...
Yeah, well, part of their pitch on the Home Hub is that they have like a home app, so you can control your smart home accessories from it. So they're like, hey, it's like a home hub, but...
I love smart home stuff, but like hub just means nothing to me.
Yeah. It's a meaningless word, right? It just means we do a load of different things.
Yeah.
Home like, hub portal is screen. Like you can look in and see and talk to your friends, right? Like it's like communication-based, and I think it's an all right idea, but they're going to struggle on price because it's more expensive than the Amazon Google things, and at the moment, they're always going to lose in terms of just raw what can you do with it. And stuff like YouTube is a big problem for those for people that aren't called Google.
Is no camera, right?
Yes, Facebook includes a camera cover in the box, so if you want to cover the camera, you can do. But then, like, you're buying a video chat client, and then you're going to cover the camera. But I don't really get that. But yeah, Google was like, for privacy, we do not include a camera at all. I don't know if they really did it for privacy reasons or they just wanted to get the price down.
Yeah, it's a weird one.
Yeah. It's definitely a strange one.
Yeah, they have cameras on their phones, so I don't know about that. And then the Echo Show 2 was announced like a few weeks ago. They had a whole event where they announced like 40 different Echo things. You know, there's always been like Amazon Alexa on everything at CES, but now Amazon has done this whole thing where they have their own stuff, like a clock, for example. And I'm really interested and a fan of like the dedicated Echo speakers at various price points. They did a new one that's like no speaker at all. It's just like an attachment to your existing speakers. And I think it's priced at where the old Dot used to be, which you can also hook up to your speakers if you want to. And I think that's too bad. Like, just bring the Dot down in price if you can and not have this, like, this speakerless thing, you know, which is a cool thing on its own. But, like, in the lineup, I think it just means that you're not going to see the Dot get as cheap anymore. And then the Dot's been changed to be much more attractive, for one, and more colors. And from what everyone says, much better sounding. Then there's like this middle Echo that has always existed last year, that's unchanged this year, and then the Echo Plus, which was like the first Echo in the beginning, is no longer plasticky, it's like cloth looking. Which, you know, I know the HomePod has like pseudo cloth looking, you know, like speaker cover plastic around it, but it isn't like actually cloth, and it's really hard and it's just like a shell for looks. I really dislike like the carpet trend on technology. You know, there were some Microsoft laptops with carpet covers on them. And
yeah, the like fabric keyboard stuff, I can't get on that train at all.
Yeah, I think the Apple iPad Smart keyboard is as close as I can get because it's like part of the cover. But like the way that these speakers look, they made me think that they're going to collect dust and like I need to vacuum them with like a little hand vac. And I like the way like plastic, you can like wipe it down and it just makes more sense to me. Plus like fabric in the kitchen, really, and it's not great. So the other new thing is in the lineup is the Echo Show 2, which is the version with a screen that used to be super ugly, like an old box TV. And now there's a new one that's a little bit better looking on the back. And like,
yeah, so the old one had like a camera above and then like the speaker grill below it, right? Yeah. So it's kind of like a vertical product, whereas this one is more... looks like a tablet with a kickstand. Like the speakers are kind of hidden in the back.
Yeah, and I think it's more cloth covered. Isn't it cloth covered too?
Yeah, I think it's probably plasticky, but yeah, it's sort of... They're all going fabrics. It's a current trend, I think. Because it's in the home. It's got to be a fabric.
It's like the 70s shag rug of technology. It's not going to age well.
I just look at... Like, all three of these different smart screen stuff, they look quite different, right? Mm-hmm. Like... You, especially the portal one's the most adventurous because you can rotate the 15-inch one to like portrait and landscape, but all of them just don't seem like they've hit the spot.
Plus, the 15-inch screen's just cool, but
but also ridiculously big. Yeah. Like, I really couldn't find a place in my house where I could put one of those things. I struggled. I still have the problem where I don't know where to put a HomePod that isn't in my office. Like, there just isn't plugs, space. Like, it's so hard to find places for stuff like this when you've already got you know, your kitchen cover or with all your utensils and stuff on it, and you've already got TV cabinets and all that stuff. It's so hard to just find place to put the stuff sometimes. But I look at all three of these quite different products that are doing the same thing, and I don't think any of them are really, like, nailed industrial design, form factor properly yet. Like, they all just... I don't know if they're all trying to be too cheap. Like, I kind of feel there's a problem where they would look better if they could be made in more premium materials, but then that also means they've been more expensive, so then people don't buy them because they're more expensive.
Sure,
like,
yeah, it makes sense.
There's a lot of conflicting problems at the moment.
Yeah.
I'm glad that people are trying this stuff out, because I feel like there's definitely something in it, but none of the current offerings, like, set my world on fire.
Yeah, I gotta say, the Echo Spot seems like the neatest of all of these, and it has nothing new this year. There's no Echo Spot 2, which I'm kind of glad about, because it'd probably be carpet covered too. And right now it's black plastic or white plastic, and I'm happy with that. And it looks kind of futury. But, I mean, on its own, it could just be a digital clock with a nice photo that you pick behind it. And it can do all the other things that an Echo can do. And it's got Alexa built in, and it can do video stuff. You can even, like, summon up video cameras that work with HomeKit that also work with Alexa. And you can view them within a circle. But it's like... You know, I think this is kind of, it's just different enough that it's a neat little form factor. But all the ones that look so much like an iPad with a million trade-offs, it's like, not that interested. Like, even the Show 2, like, getting an update, the Echo Show 2, I'm just not tempted to try that. And I've got a ton of Echoes, but, like, that doesn't really appeal to me at all.
Like, you just look at the Echo, the Show 2, and it just looks like a tablet on a kickstand, like.
Yep.
Just put a tablet on with it. Just get a portrait. Just get a stand on for your thing, and just put your iPad there when you want to do it.
Yeah, and they're not great kitchen TVs on their own either. Without, you know, the different video apps. Like, if you could nail down, you know, YouTube, like you said, Netflix and Hulu, you know, and like the Amazon ones could have like a Prime Video. That's enough content, you know, that it like almost matches an Apple TV minus the iTunes stuff. But that's still what everyone's watching, you know. And, you know, maybe get the HBO app in there and, like, stuff like that. And it's like...
And in my case, we have open plan, living room, dining room, kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
You know what we do when we're making food? We just put something on the TV.
Yeah.
Like, we have an Apple TV connected to the TV. We can play whatever we want. And then we just go about our day. You get nice loudspeakers because they're huge. You get a bigger screen. You can glance at wherever you are. Like, it really... plays my mind. Like, I feel like there's something here that could be really great, but none of the current offerings are meeting the bar.
Yeah,
the Echo wall clock thing, which is what they announced last month, is only $30. So it's actually what I envisioned, because it's just a normal wall clock with some LEDs around the outside
it's
that
like
light up the timers, and then
smart speaker.
Yeah, it's just and it just routes through another device, like it's kind of like a dumb accessory.
Mm-hmm.
If they had, like, a wall clock that it was actually, like, an OLED screen, like, a round OLED. This is the problem, right? Like, I think everyone's trying to be cheap, but I think maybe to do this right, you might have to be more expensive. Like, and give it all the functionality of, like, an Apple Watch, but on the wall. And, like, it's kind of out the way. And because it's round, you're not going to be, like, reading loads of text on it because it's on the wall, right? So you can be round. You don't have to be rounded rectangle. Like, when you're not going to be reading emails, for instance. But you get big notifications. I just feel like maybe it's a mirror. Like, it doesn't have to be a clock necessarily. But I hope someone does, like, a proper attack at that. The Amazon are getting the closest, but at the moment, they've just kind of gone into the cheap end of things. Like, if they did, like, an Echo Spot that you could put on the wall, maybe that'd be, like... better.
Yeah, even in the kitchen TV space, like, our kitchen is kind of closing on to its own, but we do have a small, I think, 22 inch LCD 720p TV connected to an Apple TV, and I never use it. It's like, if I'm gonna go in there and do the dishes and cook a meal, I'm probably playing a podcast, and if I do video, I'm probably gonna just, like, bring my iPad for the video, and so I don't touch it, but because it isn't, like, so better of an experience than the other stuff that I've already got on me, but it's there, you know. But yeah, none of this stuff is I think it's interesting.
I still think if you want Christmas gifts, buy cylinders like dots or the echoes and stuff. Like,
yeah.
I just think they're more useful. You can put them in loads of more different places and they're not really expensive and they're just better. It's just not, it's just the truth.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say about the echo stuff is, my daughter's five and she's really good with all the voice control, whether it's Siri or Alexa. And so she will, like, if I'm outside doing yard work or something and she's inside and I say, like, if you need me, call me. I usually say, like, on your iPad, FaceTime me or something, rather than, like, come out and look for me and, like, get lost outside on your own, you know? And what she'll actually do is use the echoes to call me. And she, you know, says, Alexa, you know, call Zach. And even though they're all on my account, they still ring me as if they're, like, another echo. And the Alexa app on my iPhone rings like a native phone call, and I can answer it. And if it's one of these echoes with a screen on it, then I can see her and she can see me. Hang on a second. Yeah. I'll leave it in there, but I hit mute whenever it lit up and it was too late. So, oh well. But yeah, she'll call me and, like, it's so neat. And the other day I thought of, I wanted to call her while I was outside. And so I opened the Alexa app on my iPhone and you just, like, press a little button and it's like, you know, the voice assistant summons. And I said, drop in on the living room, took a guess at where she was. And it just, like, answered the echo in the living room. And I said, hey, Emily. And she was like, hey, what? And it's like, that feels neat. And I can't do that with the iPad. And I can call her, but she has to answer and stuff like that. And it's like, so there's some benefits to some of this stuff. But I'm more open to what Amazon's doing. And I'm not a fan of these, like, TVs, like, you know, like TV video screens, you know. I'm more open to, like, the Spot and what they're doing there.
Yeah.
And the one that we used, I mean, it was just, like, the regular Echo. It wasn't even one with a screen. So if it had a screen, I would have seen it, but it was just an audio call. And that was neat. So, yeah, a lot of new video screens this year. None get the happy hour endorsement. So. And I don't think, like, with the HomePod, it was, like, this pent-up demand for Apple to have something like it, like an Echo. But I don't think we've got that. I think that the iPad, you know, through and the iPhone for that matter, with Siri getting better, it offers all you need, really. So, yeah. Two China stories to get to this week. One got a lot more attention than the other. But tell me a little bit about what's going on in China with the security story.
This is so crazy. Like, Bloomberg had this massive piece saying that Apple's servers that they'd contracted through a company called Supermicro had been infected with a hardware hack where they had, like, a chip the size of a grain of rice on these motherboards that wasn't part of the original design and was apparently talking back to, like, the Chinese military, like, essentially industrial espionage on a massive scale, not through software but through hardware. And then about 2 hours later, Amazon was implicated, Apple was implicated, Supermicro was implicated in the story, and all three of them come out with, like, incredibly blunt denials. Like, not whiffy-waffy, we're looking into this, thanks to the report. It was like, we don't have a clue what they're on about. It was just mad. Like, the Apple statement they gave was seven paragraphs. Seven paragraphs, like, desecrating everything that Bloomberg had said. I've never seen Apple with a statement like that ever. It was absolutely wild. Like, the headline of my story wasn't "Report says Apple servers hacked by Chinese spy chips." It was "Apple refutes strongly claim that this happens," because I don't know. Maybe Bloomberg is right. Right? They seem to be pretty confident in their sources, and they're generally a pretty good publication. Maybe they're right, but Apple and Amazon have a lot more to lose by denying this outright than Bloomberg has for publishing this story in the first place. Like,
there's so much complexity to this of things that I just have no idea about, but the interesting things are the story was published, and it wasn't like it was published and then Apple responded. It was published with Apple's denial in it, and I think with Amazon's too, right?
Yep.
Like, that was part of the
original story. Actually, Bloomberg had an entirely separate post just including the denials from the three companies because they were so long. Like, there was like a 1,000-word article just full of Amazon, Apple's, and Sid Micro's rejections of the story. It was so funny.
And it wasn't like a last-minute denial. Like the way that Apple framed it was that they've been working for months on this, denying it for months, and then Bloomberg, you know, wouldn't go away.
And yes, military budgets, Chinese, US, worldwide spies have billions and billions of dollars, but there are physical limits on what can be done, right? Apple is the biggest company in the world. I think they have a pretty good understanding of the limits of technology, right? The idea of this grain of rice chip that could somehow spy on what was going through the servers and then send that out to elsewhere, just instinctively from my head, like, you have to be connected to the internet to be able to talk to something else, right? And these servers aren't just like out on the open web. They're behind all these like company firewalls and all these protections and securities. If this chip could somehow contact a server that wasn't like the Apple CDN, it would flag up a million times over on the way out of these places. Like, I don't even know if a chip the size of a grain of rice could include enough parts that could do this stuff. Like, it's so small. You definitely couldn't have a Wi-Fi antenna, for instance. Like, your best guess is that you're going to redirect some internet traffic over the Ethernet ports on these servers, right? But those Ethernet ports don't go unchecked. Like, they go through external firewalls and stuff that block weird ports, that block weird domains.
Yeah.
They're always on the lookout for this stuff. Like, it seems fishy to me. Like, maybe they tried it. Maybe they tried to do this and they got caught. But even that feels like, it feels far too much like sci-fi to me than reality.
Did you read the full Bloomberg Businessweek piece?
I read everything.
Okay, so you read it word to word. By the way,
one thing I do want to point out, yeah. I think people put too much faith in Bloomberg because the fact that the cover picture had a picture of the chip. That is not a picture of the chip, it's an illustration mock-up.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Okay, so you read it, you know this in and out. Do they claim that there's a start and end date, like this is not an ongoing thing, this is a thing that happened and that it stopped happening, like Apple stopped doing business with them, or it was discovered and...
Right, so they say it was detected in May 2015, and Apple stopped using Supermicro servers a year later.
Yeah, and part of
Apple says they stopped using the Supermicro servers for an unrelated reason, because obviously Apple's denying this whole thing.
Yeah, part of Apple's denial is that there was another issue that made them stop using them, and was it in part of an acquisition that they even did business with this company with these servers? Do they make any claims about like what customer data, like what was exposed on the server, and like specifically?
Bloomberg does not say that customer data was exposed. Mm. It makes vague allusions to like company data being exposed, but nothing concrete. Bloomberg never has, like, in the story they have all these illustrations of all these boards. They're all just Photoshop mock-ups. Like, they don't actually have, nobody has actually found a chip, right, like, or at least has gone on the record showing a chip,
right? This is according to sources, this thing happened, you know,
and Bloomberg says they got lots of different sources inside Apple, inside Amazon, and inside the FBI, but or at least externally, nobody's coming forward. And even Apple said, like, we are not under a gag order. We are not doing this. We have no idea what they're talking about. Like, we are really disappointed that Bloomberg have published this. We've been working with them since November 2017. So a year ago.
Yeah.
And then it comes out and still everyone is so denying it. Like, it is a very weird situation.
Yeah, that's the part of, like, where the story... how it unfolds has been interesting to me, but like the story itself, like the core of it has been vague to me because I don't quite have a handle on like, and I guess because they don't claim what, so they kind of describe like what happened, how it happened, but not like what the effect was, what was exposed, what was being done with the information. Like that part of it is so murky to me that I just can't really hold the story and appreciate it beyond like the big Apple denial and like every government agency denying it, or you know, like not confirming it, people off the record at Apple saying no idea, you know. And I can actually, like, my mind, I can see something way more complex that you know, the conspiracy side of it. I can entertain that in my mind, but I don't think any of it was going to become provable, you know, at this point. It's just to me, like, I just couldn't tell you what happened here. Like, who benefited from this? You know, what did they take?
Well, the one of the lines of the like the narrative is that Supermicro is government authorized, so they provide servers to government institutions like the military. So the illusion was that if China's putting spy chips in these boards, that they can spy on the US military. But again, there wasn't any proof, there wasn't any record. It was just kind of like hypothetical, like these boards have been found and they might have been doing this. Like, it's in some ways the Bloom report was very detailed, in many other ways it was very loose.
Right. Yeah.
And I think things like the picture of the tiny little chip on the thumbnail gave people false belief in it that only just like skimmed the headline in the picture.
Sure. Yeah.
I think that picture was pretty deceptive. Like, the rest of the story, it was claimed by, they said according to sources, and then they include, like, Apple's rejection in the body of the story. So I don't think, like, Bloomberg's, like, pulling a false one or anything like that. They're just, they obviously believe in the information they've told it. For me, it comes down to the fact that Apple and Amazon are, like, the biggest companies in the world, and they have far more to lose from outright denying this than just doing, like, no comments or similar vague statements. Like, they can get sued if they turn out to be lying here. Like, they'll get sued five ways to Sunday. Bloomberg, if they post an incorrect story, you know, in 2 months' time, nobody will remember and just move on. Like, there's a massive weight of responsibility on the titans of the tech industry's shoulders, not this publication. Like, Bloomberg is a well-known publication, but say the story comes out to be completely false, Bloomberg will be absolutely fine, and in 6 months' time, no one will even remember. It would be a glint in history, and everyone would have moved on. Like, it's just incredibly imbalanced on who would be telling the truth. And it's not just Apple coming out outright. It's Amazon. It's everyone that they implicate. Like, it seems really, really fishy.
Mm. Yeah. So some things here. A couple of things that I can be interested in is like how Apple treats Bloomberg going forward. And specifically, this is a Bloomberg Business Week story, which Business Week was like bought by Bloomberg a long time ago. And it's like primarily a print magazine, I believe. And this is, you know, like their cover story for the next print version. And it's online, of course, you know, because it's the media age, digital media. But I think it's definitely like a different organization than like Bloomberg Technology, like where Mark Gurman's a big part of.
Yeah.
And it's this, you know, at the top it's the same. I guess it all comes from Mike Bloomberg, you know, very wealthy person. But it's like there is a difference between Bloomberg Business Week and Bloomberg Technology, Bloomberg on the web, that is like the terminal kind of Bloomberg, I think. So that there's some differences there, but
Bloomberg, like, I think Bloomberg will still be invited to the next Apple event.
Right.
But I don't think they're going to get cut off.
Yeah, but Bloomberg Business Week specifically, the print magazine Bloomberg Business Week, in the past has kind of been an Apple favorite. Like, I believe whenever Tim Cook came out for the first time, like publicly spoke about it, it was to Bloomberg Business Week, and they wanted, like, I think in our first story we might have just said Bloomberg, and they said, can you change it to Bloomberg Business Week or just Business Week? Like, that was a detail that they cared about in our story about their story. But like, and that was a very strategic, you know, outlet to choose, because it's Business Week, and the idea is the CEO of Apple can be gay and be the CEO of Apple and tell it to the business community and say, look, Apple's doing fine, and I can share that I'm gay and that everything is okay. Like, and that was a big deal at the time. And now it just seems like, you know, accepted. But you know, I mean, there was a time before that had happened. And but they chose Business Week for that. And then there have been other like access profile stories where Apple chose Business Week because of like their audience, you know. And I wonder if that changes now. Like, there's got to be a calculation of, you know, I mean, Apple Public Relations is not like Bloomberg Business Week now, and probably for the last year they haven't liked them as this story has been buzzing around.
Apple PR sent statements to other publications saying that the Bloomberg story is wrong before people even inquired about it. Like, they literally sent a statement to like Mashable saying Bloomberg is inaccurate. Like, Is that they clearly don't like them?
Yeah, and they had the Apple press release of what Business Week got wrong about Apple, and that's a very long, you know, piece, and it puts someone's name on it, you know. So it's that whole part.
Yeah,
of it.
They out right name Bloomberg journalists. It's
yeah,
like,
yeah,
Apple went hard.
So yeah,
and
so
it's really hard to ignore that. Like, it's so easy to just fall into the conspiracy theory trap. Oh, of course they would say that. Of course they would. But like, you know, you have to be realistic. Like, Apple has investors, they have finance, they have shareholders, they have the board. They have their reputation on the line. Like, it is a big deal to say this stuff so bluntly. And you can definitely, and in the past, of course, Apple PR has done weird like things where they spin stories in their favor. But like, the language of those are completely different to the language of what they've been doing here. Like, they literally have like the head of their information security department outright saying that this is like quote unquote rubbish.
Yeah, I'll make no claim about like if I believe Apple or Business Week or somewhere in the middle, because to me, I don't know. I don't have a way of knowing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know either. Like, yeah. Who knows?
Yeah, I'm just not even inclined to like think that one is right than the other, and I am inclined to think that there could be a lot that we don't know and reasons to not be open about all of it. But it's super weird. Like, it definitely is. And maybe, you know, I mean, Apple's denial, the press release denial, tries to draw attention to another unrelated story that they might be confusing this with. And that's like the most pointed thing about it all, is that they say that Business Week journalists like refuse to accept that this might be that, and that, you know, that they're just wrong.
Well, we will find out if this is true. We will find out eventually, because they say an FBI investigation is ongoing, and at some point it will have to be public information, right? Because it's government. So
maybe
we will see.
I don't know.
I mean, there'll be, like, they can't keep this whole thing classified forever, like, indefinitely. Just impossible.
I don't know. I mean,
well, if this report can come out, surely more could.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's a difference in, like, living in the US.
They sent
UK,
Supermicro sent servers to thousands of companies, right? Like, surely someone can find this chip if it exists.
Yeah, maybe. I don't think the truth.
Show me a chip and I'll believe.
I don't think that I am optimistic as a person, but I'm not sure that in these situations the truth always gets out there. Like, there are big American mysteries that are never solved, you know, and like, justice does not always prevail. And so for that reason, like, I mean, this isn't like a life or death thing to, you know, on the surface, like it can be. It's, you know, seems like there could be a hidden mystery forever that we just never know. But you know, that's all I can look at is like, how does Apple treat Business Week going forward? Like, do they continue to get access to Tim Cook and Johnny Ive like profiles that benefit Apple because of who their, you know, audience is? And
yeah, I would not expect interviews with Apple executives turning up in Business Week anytime soon.
Yeah, they infamously had that like super goofy cover of Tim Cook with no glasses and like teenage writing over it. And it's like,
yeah, that was rough.
Yeah, funny history there. The other Chinese story comes from The Information this week, and it was about fraud and like the cost that has had down Apple and like how they've managed it, right?
Yeah, so there's not too much like analysis here, but it's just kind of an interesting stat that like in 2013, Apple set aside $1.6 billion for warranty repairs, and they ultimately ended up spending $3.7 billion, so double essentially. And it turns out that what was happening was that at Chinese Apple stores, like hundreds and hundreds of crime gangs were bringing in iPhones, taking out valuable parts like the CPU, then going to the Apple store saying their iPhone's broken, getting the iPhone replaced with a new one, and then selling the parts on in the black markets, right? And making money off of it. And rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat. And Apple, this is a report from The Information. Apple is depicted as like originally laughing it off, like early on, like they didn't think it was a big problem. They estimated that this kind of warranty fraud was like below 10% of Chinese repairs, and then they did some more investigations, and it turned out to be like 50%, and it grew to 60% at its peak. So more repairs were fraudulent than real. And the way they detected this, well, one of the ways they detected this was happening, is that they counted whether an iPhone that got a warranty repair got logged into the same Apple ID that it had before it was repaired. Because if it was going to be sold on, someone else would buy it and log into their own account. And if there was that mismatch, it's likely to be a fraudulent repair.
Mm.
And apparently a data scientist did this in like 2013, and that got the executive's attention, right? And they were like, holy moly, we've got to deal with this. And then the rest of the information article is like a back and forth of Apple trying to require these steps, like you have to get an appointment and do proof of identity online. Then the criminals would get around that. And then the next step is they would have to make you come into the store. And then it gets really violent at one point where some Apple store employees were getting like bribed in China. And then when they refused, they were getting like threatened with like cattle prods, like get really intense. And then more recently, Apple's been applying like invisible spray to the CPU so that they can detect if these chips are real or counterfeited. And then they've gotten, and like one, at one point they had a software solution that could tell you if they were using legitimate components. So what did the hackers do? What did the thieves do? They made sure that the iPhones could not turn on when they got the repairs because then the software couldn't be run. Like it's just this back and forth, back and back, yeah. back and forth. And then finally, in 2017, Apple's payments, total payments for iPhone repair warranties went down. So it finally feels like it took them almost 5 years and they finally got on top of the problem. But in classic fashion, the information now says similar scams are starting up in Turkey and the United Arab Emirates. So
dun, dun, dun.
But this is like a crazy like five-year endeavor from like Apple trying to stop this stuff from happening and then the thieves like taking it to increasingly higher degrees of complexity and sophistication.
Yeah, I'm not trying to make a smooth or bad segue here, but this would be like a really, you know, this article would be a good like mini series, you know, on TV. like you could visualize, like have simulations, you know, acting and you know, show all of this stuff out, and you'd be like, what's happening, you know? And in the end,
that whole thing that I described would be like an incredible hour-long documentary.
Exactly. And it ends with like it's not resolved entirely, you know. So moving on, Carpool Karaoke 2 has a launch date.
It's a serious documentary. No?
And I know we don't care about Carpool Karaoke, but the interesting thing here is that with the first season, it was Apple Music subscribers only. So a paid member or a free trial member, but you had to have a membership to see it. And the problem was, you know, this goofy music-based celebrity, you know, focused show, comedy, you know, I guess is like trapped behind this membership. So you can't share it, can't go viral on YouTube, and you've got to pay an unrelated subscription fee to see it, you know, for your music library. And it just happens to be kind of music related. And then they eventually made where in the TV app on iPhone, iPad, and Apple TV, old episodes began to be available each week, like on Friday. And so it had like more traditional, you know, one episode a week of old episodes, but for free. And this week, they announced the release date of season 2, which is Friday, October the 12th. And with this run, from the start, they're going to have every episode be a new episode on Friday through the TV app for free. So they've just abandoned the whole pay for Apple Music to get access to this thing. And that makes a lot more sense, like, on its own.
It's so much better.
Regardless of, like, anything else Apple's doing in TV. Yeah.
Like, Carpool Karaoke is a viral show. You don't want to put viral content behind a paywall. Like, it's just not going to work. This isn't quite as open as just putting the videos on YouTube,
mm-hmm.
which would be like the ultimate viral landing spot. But this is so much better because basically anyone with an Apple device can talk about this and then actually go and watch it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it basically then just serves as an ad for Apple Music, right? Like, it's just promotional content for Apple Music.
Yeah, and maybe they could even be more involved than YouTube. I mean, the trailer announcing this is on YouTube, and they do lots of stuff on YouTube. I think they do some clips from the show on YouTube. But yeah, maybe they could eventually like give that and do the whole YouTube thing, or make TV stuff in the TV app more shareable, you know, online.
You do like a WebEx, you know, like how you can share a link to an app. You could share a link to an episode and then just watch it online, for instance.
Yeah. So just like there's music kit for the Apple Music stuff, you could have TV kit for the video. And the other thing that's kind of related to this is CNBC had a very hand-wavy report that makes some sort of a claim that some Apple TV, some original content that Apple's been producing will be available for free. They're just going to give it away, like the PG-rated stuff. But then some of the more racy stuff might be paid. Like, the whole report was very wordy, and I don't think it had a super definitive like nugget in it, except to claim that like some stuff will be free.
Yeah, which is kind of an empty statement, right? Because you could argue that some stuff it was in Apple Music is free. You get a 3 month trial.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to have to give something away for free, even if it's just a trial. Yeah. Like,
I think the CNBC report was like trying to say that some of the super family-friendly stuff, like the whole season, will be free, but it wasn't that explicit and clear. And, you know, realistically, like maybe it's like the first few episodes, you know, you get 3 episodes of each and then you got to pay to finish them, you know? There's so many things they could do here.
For me, it doesn't make sense to have them free forever because you're just devaluing your content.
Why bother?
Yeah, like you're going to say, oh, it's worth it to pay $10 a month for HBO, but our stuff's not good enough, so we just give it to you. But you need to hook people in the first place. So I could say that I could easily see like the first year of this of Apple's original shows are free. And then they'll tell you, you're getting a year free trial, and then we'll renew at whatever rate.
Yeah.
Like, they need to hook you in with like a free period, whether it's the first half of the season, for instance, or the first one season. And then by the time the first season's over, the second season's out, and then it's time to upgrade and actually start paying for it. Like, I think there's no way that Apple would make all this content and just give it away for free forever. But an introductory trial is almost so obvious. It's like, why write a story about it in the first place, if you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I mean, they're investing real money into this service. The content for Apple is not free. And their focus in so many areas is about increasing their services revenue. I mean, that business is growing for Apple. They've got a very high target for where they want it to go. And, you know, it's iPhone's still like the big money maker, but like so are services for Apple. And this is part of that. So just to make all this stuff, hire all these people, put all this money behind it to make the iPhone and iPad and Apple TV more appealing. Like, they don't think they have to do that. And they have this lofty services goal, you know, for revenue. So the CNBC report, it didn't feel so good. They did include the detail that Apple will also sell access to like HBO and I guess Showtime and services like that through the TV app, which is something Amazon already does. And that Bloomberg, not Business Week, but Bloomberg, Mark Gurman and a colleague had already reported that bit. So, I don't. This story like wasn't a huge whopper for me.
Yeah, I guess the best thing it does say is expected to launch early next year. So
yeah, which there was the one New York Times story that was about an environmental documentary, like an article series that is becoming a series, a video series, and they say like on the record there that Apple says next year for this thing. And I had followed up to ask, like, is that what you're saying about the video service itself? And, like, because it would make it sound like, and no one, you know, replied on that one. But, early next year.
But, I mean, early next year means not fall, if you see what I mean.
Sure, right? Yeah.
Because I think the next likely, I was working on that it might not be until the September event of 2019, right?
Sure, but
if they say early next year, then it kind of feels more like a spring event type of situation.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then this week, Guy Rambo had uncovered some information about new iPads that he learned in various ways. One interesting detail there, I mean, we have all these rumors about the iPad Pro and like, what to expect about it, an 11-inch screen and a 12.9-inch screen, so a bigger screen than the 10.5-inch version and then the 12.9-inch iPad Pro, but with a slim bezel on both of them. And Rambo found some information that suggests that the Face ID camera will work in portrait and landscape mode, but you'll need to set it up in portrait mode. And so it's not only further confirmation that Face ID is coming to the iPad, but also how it will work, which is a neat detail.
It's kind of weird that it requires portrait setup, but can work in portrait and landscape. But
yeah.
Sounds strange.
There's some weird stuff coming there. And then more evidence of USB-C. So Ming-Chi Kuo was the first one to mention that the new iPad Pros will include USB-C in favor of Lightning, which at the time was like, we just couldn't find a way that he was miscommunicating the charging in that goes into the wall adapter, that it was the port itself.
Yeah, he was very careful in stating that.
Right. And so Guy Rambo found more evidence that USB-C is an interface here.
I'll just make one quick prediction on the USB-C thing, because everyone's going a bit crazy, being like, they're going to turn the iPad into a real computer. I expect that the USB-C port will do nothing more than what you can currently do with the Lightning to USB adapter, where you can plug in like some microphones and keyboards and just by using the USB port, right?
Yeah.
I expect that's all it will do, plus it can output to a 4K display.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to let you plug in a mouse and have a cursor on the screen or any of that stuff. Maybe they move down there in future OS updates, but I don't think they're going to... I'm doubtful they'll even do that. Like, I do not think this is a move... Like, you're not going to be able to plug in an external hard drive and then just start copying files off the USB-C port. Yeah. It's just not going to happen. In my opinion, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I think that if it were, that we'd be learning about it in the same way that Guy is finding stuff like 4K HDR video output over USB-C. And I also don't think that it's like Lightning to USB-C to HDMI, that it is indeed like USB-C on the tablet itself.
Yeah.
And I don't see two ports on the iPad, no, in this way. And he found evidence that there will be a new Apple Pencil and that it'll pair in a similar way to what AirPods do, where they're nearby and it goes through the whole detection phase. So that's neat. We haven't had a new Pencil since the first one.
It sounds like a combination of what the Crayon does, the Logitech Crayon, which is proximity-based, and what the AirPods do. So like the Crayon, you don't need any pairing whatsoever. You can just walk up to sixth generation iPad and just tap the screen and it will start working. The way Rambo describes this is that there still will be some setup, but you won't have to like uncap the Pencil, plug it into the bottom of the connector, etc. So
yeah, as you go from the current Pencil relies on to pair the Lightning port and it's got a Lightning Melon on the Pencil, you know, so as you change to USB-C, some options become necessary there, even if it's an adapter in between. But just foregoing the whole plug it in thing might help, although with charging maybe that's still the method. But there's some stuff there. He also found evidence that magnetic connector is referenced on this iPad, which is, you know, a little unclear. Like, smart connector is magnetic, isn't it? So But we have seen through some leaks that the smart connector moves, if not changes. So just some more evidence that what we've been seeing in the leaks, you know, is probably the real thing.
I would guess that the Pencil now charges on the magnetic connector rather than plugging it in.
Yeah, it's going to be different.
Although it's kind of stupid, because while you're waiting for the Pencil to charge, you can't lay your iPad flat.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It's on the back. Definitely some question marks in that area.
And will a smart keyboard case interface through that connection? And can you charge a Pencil and use a keyboard case? And it's like, we've got some questions to answer when this event ever happens.
I'm so excited to see the new iPad, though. I just think it's going to look so stylish, like with the thin bezels and stuff. Like,
Yeah.
It's going to be really pretty.
Yeah, I'm super excited for it. Finally, I want to end on two bits of... little bit of follow-up and a little bit of stuff in the running corner that we do occasionally. But last week we mentioned my Apple TV Dolby Atmos input woes. Just to summarize, I could not use HDMI CEC, where you turn the TV on with the Apple TV remote, and do Dolby Atmos with my Atmos soundbar. And it would go to HDMI 4, which had nothing attached to the input. And so we had to fish out the actual TV remote and flip through the inputs. It took a few days where I just went back to the classic like optical cable way, and then I gave up Atmos, and then my family was happy because we weren't getting the wrong input, and magic solution. But then I did get feedback from four or five people, listeners, that was very helpful. In some situations, it may come down to my TV being an LG B7 model of OLED, and it not being able to power and process Atmos on its own. But the C7 can, evidently. But ultimately what it came down to was plugging in the Apple TV through an HDMI port and plugging in the soundbar through another HDMI port. And I always thought of the TV HDMI ports as inputs. Like, you plug up a device to it and it goes to the TV. It doesn't send data.
Yeah, it displays it.
Yeah, it doesn't send data from the TV to like what it's connected to. But evidently that's not the case. That it goes both ways, which I guess for a lot of people maybe is like known. But then also on my soundbar, I'm using the HDMI out port, I think, to go into the TV. And it's just like, and really sending audio from the TV through the HDMI out port on the soundbar. So it's confusing in how it works. I never would have guessed to try this, but a few people recommended it, and it works. So I've got four HDMI ports, which is a lot for modern TVs, and one is taken up by the soundbar, and the other is the Apple TV, and then like another is a PlayStation, and another is a Nintendo Switch. So all four are taken by three input devices and one output device, but at last...
The CEC is working.
The CEC is totally working. I'm playing Atmos, I've got Dolby Vision, and it's what I expected to work, and now it works, and I'm really happy about that. The only thing is, like, there's like a slight delay when you turn on the TV through the Siri remote. You know, Apple TV comes on, TV lights up, you see everything, and then the soundboard like catches up with it at first. Like nothing, there's no sound at first, and then it catches up. But then at that point, like it's a matter of seconds, and then everything is in sync. You know, it's all powered on. And it's way more convenient than having the big TV remote out too, because there's two one remote's better than two. So I'm happy there. The other thing is that the Nike Run Club app on the Apple Watch is made for the smaller screens, and Apple has a version of the Series 4 watch that's the Nike Plus version that's got these new watch faces, and has which have the complication for the Nike Run Club app. Like default, you can't change it, and you can change the face, but not that complication. And I expected when I was reviewing the watch, the Nike Run Club app would be updated for the new screen sizes before that watch came out, because it had a 2 week later release date. And like, that's probably why I thought that it was later, as every year. Well, it's been like 3 weeks now and they haven't updated the app yet. And it's becoming like a joke to like check the app store, look for it. And it's just incredible that it's not been updated
yet. That is so stupid. Like the Nike faces have a launcher button for the Nike Run Club app, right? Yep. And so that's essentially default on the watch faces of this Nike Plus Run Club and of the Nike Plus watches. And the Run Club app does not take advantage of the screen. Yeah. It's just letterboxed. Like, it's like, come on. That it's so like, dumb.
It's the Apple Watch Nike Plus. Like, it's not the Apple Watch Sport that you can install the app on. Like, it's part of it. And Tim Cook is like has a role on the board at Nike. Like, it's there's this connection there, and they've not got this sorted out. And at WWDC last year, you know, me and friend of the show Kyle Seth Gray were talking in line for the WWDC run, and he happened to be talking to some Nike Run Club like engineers. And they were just like super unaware of all the problems with how the app performs. And it's just like amazing to me that there can be this partnership in this watch that's the Apple Watch Nike Plus, but then the app is like on its own somewhere in development, and Apple seems to have like no control over it. And there are screenshots on the website of it working and, you know, updated for the full screen. And like, I think maybe even the icon changes colors from volt yellow to white. But it's not in the App Store yet. And if you buy the watch, like, you get the old app, and it's just remarkable to me. And the other
it's like one of those cases where Apple's like put its hands up and say, it's not our fault. Yeah. It's not, but you know, you're selling the watch, like it's got your logo on it. It's your fault. Like,
yeah.
It's like a big company thing where no, it's not our problem, but it is. Do yeah, it.
That might as well be your app. They need to have a little bit more grip on the way it's been developed. I mean, early on, like, it was really buggy, and that was a problem, and they've come around on that. But just like not being optimized for the hardware that it's being sold on is just not good. Because none of Apple's apps are like that. They've all been updated, you know, just to fit the screen, nothing else, if nothing else. So that's been interesting to watch. And they also promote the Nike Training Club app for the watch. And it's not updated either for the new screen size, but it's just kind of goofy because it says like start your workout on the phone. I don't think it's like different types of exercise that the workout app doesn't optimize for. So that's weird. And the last thing in that space is that the reflective Nike band, the Nike Sport Loop, that comes in black or Summit white. The difference there is that the yarn, Apple says, is reflective. And so when light shines on it, it lights up. So it's good for visibility in dark areas. So car headlights, you know, see you. They see the person running. you're less likely to get, you know, nicked. So those are neat, but they don't sell them on their own. And my prediction is that they'll be sold on their own in March or April when there's like a spring event 6 months later. But I really want one. So I looked to eBay and I found one that was less than $150, more than the $50 it'll probably be sold for eventually. And I ordered one. It came today and I'm really happy with it because it's like, it's subtle in light, like, you know, not in like a dark area, but like just like normal light. But then if you're in a dark area and light shines on it, then it's like super reflective for a black band in this case. It's almost like it's got like this hidden like metallic layer under it. So I'm trying that out. I've been doing night runs anyway. And so, this is just one more thing, to help with that. But the thing is like, I also wear like a yellow reflective vest with the front and back light on it too. And, if I run at night, I wear like a headlamp. So it's just not the thing that's going to save me from being, you know, invisible.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like a cool gimmick though, right? Like the little wristband that shines up is not going to save you. Like you need the normal gear and the lights and stuff. Like,
it sounds like
a cool concept though.
Yeah, it is a neat thing. And I'm looking forward to when they sell them on their own and maybe have like more colors too. But for now, if you're in the market for one, look to eBay. People are selling them for a big profit, which is kind of nice. Like if you buy the Nike Sport Watch for, what is it, like $380 to $410 or so, then you can make back some money in that case. So that's nice. But get mine today. I plan on doing a hands-on with it, like, you know, comparing it to just like Apple's black multicolored. It's just black, but it's got a lot of colors in it. Sport loop, and showing off how the light reflects on it and how it reacts. But it's a neat thing. It's you know, with the original sport bands, the Apples were solid and Nikes were perforated with like more breathable holes, which was like a neat take on it. But last year with the Nike sport loops, they were just different colors, like crimson, red, and you know, like solid black. This year, there's something like functionally different about them, which is a good thing. But so look for a story on how it compares. And with that being said, we did a lot of topics this week.
We really run the gauntlet today.
It was a slow week, and it was like, what are we going to talk about this week? So we just like looked, you know, at what's happened since the last episode, and there's been enough small stuff. We got an episode out of it. But with that being said, that's the Happy Hour podcast for this week. If you have any feedback, let us know. We're on Twitter. I'm at ApolloZach. I'm Benjamin. You are?
BZA Mayo.
And you can also email us at happyhour@95mac.com. And we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.